Good evening. It's Saturday, May 2nd. Protesters clash across the country as some rally to reopen the country and others rally against it.
And you actually had two things squaring off. Of are we looking at this in terms of me and my job, or are we looking at this in terms of the interests of all of humanity?
The state of Louisiana incarcerates more people per capita than any other state in the country, putting the mostly black inmates at risk for contracting COVID-19.
It's a death sentence on black people here in the state of Louisiana. In our prisons and jails, it is horrific.
And workers across the country walked off job sites to join picket lines for International Workers' Day, asking for fair wages, health insurance, and protective gear.
Now suddenly we're promoting them as heroes, and yet we are still exploiting them.
With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News.
Spaniards were out on the streets exercising for the first time in 7 weeks, while German children rushed to playgrounds as countries in Western Europe moved ahead with the gradual relaxation of coronavirus lockdown restrictions. But in a sign the pandemic is far from over, Russia and Pakistan reported their biggest one-day spikes in new infections. Concern was growing in Moscow that hospitals might become overwhelmed after Russia recorded a new one-day high of 9,633 new infections, a 20% increase over Friday's count, which itself was a new daily record. Russia has now reported 124,000 total cases, with 15,000 recoveries and 1,200 fatalities. According to a count kept by Johns Hopkins University, the virus has killed more than 238,000 people worldwide, including more than 65,000 in the United States and more than 20,000 each in Italy, Britain, and France.
As Reopen America rallies erupted across the country on Friday, Refuse Fascism organizers led counter-protests in cities across the country while practicing social distancing, with the message that the well-being of humanity should trump individual rights and that it's time for the Trump-Pence administration to go. Andy Z is the co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org. Z says the future of humanity is on the line and complacency is simply not an option.
In the cover of the Chicago Sun-Times, there is two pictures. Pictures are of these Trump people with their America First, open the country, and a picture of Refuse Fascism saying, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. And in Los Angeles, the press coverage, it was very sharply joined. In fact, you actually had, and in actuality, it was very joined. You had just really screaming yahoos, screaming America First, America First. And then on the other side, Refuse Fascism, together with the RevComs, the Revolutionary Communist followers of Abubakian, were out there also saying, humanity first, humanity first. And you actually had two things squaring off. Of are we looking at this in terms of me and my job, or are we looking at this in terms of the interests of all of humanity?
And I think you've laid out the issue super well. So there's these tensions between people who are struggling already and want to earn money because they have to. And this other mentality of like, we aren't prepared. We don't have what we need. And then there's this other party that you're talking about who have these ideologies like me first, I want my rights. So how do we reconcile all these positions?
You can't reconcile them. That's the point. For the immigrants and for those who are forced into working in this situation, risk serious illness, risk death for myself or my relatives, or starvation in the sense of not having a job. That's the reality they face. But that's writ large on a world scale and within this country. Getting rid of these restrictions right now before there is herd immunity, but who do you think is already bearing the brunt of this and will bear the brunt of this? That is black people, people in the prisons, people in the detention camps, immigrants who are forced even now to go to work in very unsafe conditions and next to each other, just look at the meatpacking plants, people south of the border, and this pandemic is going to spread around the world because of the outrageously anti-scientific practices that are in this country fomented by Donald Trump. And this is not something separate, just an anti-science thing in relationship to the disease, but is very concentrated in the whole approach of this regime.
What is it that gives you the inner fight, the inner willingness to keep fighting in spite of what you're facing?
But where my optimism comes from is one, look, I've seen, and so have you, seen people all around the world get in the streets in their millions to drive regimes from power. This is possible. America is a tough place to do this. People are so blinded by American exceptionalism, including the progressive community. There's just something about the American experiment. No, there isn't. This is founded on slavery and genocide. There's nothing about this experiment. This is a ridiculous and outmoded country and system. It's not an easy road. It's the hardest road. There's no immediate gratification. I get that. But you know what? When you're marching towards a cliff, you better try to figure out, marching off a cliff rather, you better figure out how to get off that path and get on a different path.
That's Andy Z from RefuseFascism.org.
Over the last few weeks, the media has been filled with rumors of the death of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. There now seems to be proof that Kim is alive. To find out more, KPFA spoke with Christine Ahn, the executive director of Women Cross DMZ, a group dedicated to finally ending the Korean War. We asked her about the rumors of Kim's demise.
We know that that rumor of Kim Jong-un being ill or passing has just really blown up. And it is the classic example of an echo chamber that then becomes truth. And the origin of this rumor began with a piece citing an anonymous source in a South Korean-based news site called NK Daily. It's largely run by North Korean defectors. And CNN then ran it as if it were fact checked and true, and it just created this pandemonium where experts have now been forced to respond to the question, if Kim Jong-un passes away, then what? What we do know is that South Korean officials, President Moon's senior envoy Moon Chung-in, recently said on Fox News, Kim Jong-un is alive and well. They have no other reason or other indications that something is wrong with the leader. But it does present a question of what do we know?
I guess you've heard the rumors that North Korea, like other countries, has doubles for their leaders. And in case something happens to Kim Jong-un, they would simply replace him with one of the doubles. Is that a story?
I know. Well, there's so much palace intrigue. And I think, you know, what is worth interrogating is, you know, who would succeed Kim Jong-un in the event that he were to fall sick
and or to die. As a possibility.
Well, Kim Yo-jong is obviously a natural successor, but a colleague, Henri Ferrand, who is a legal scholar with the Center for International Policy, recently wrote a piece that if you look at North Korea's constitution, the successor in the event that something urgent and unexpected happens to Kim Jong-un is that the natural successor in the interim period until the Supreme People's Assembly, which is like their Congress, their legislative body, would put into power Choe Young-hae. And Choe Young-hae he's like the number two under Kim Jong-un. There's rumors that his son, Tae-sung, is married to Kim Jo-jung. And so they have, you know, that would make sense that they are, you know, ensuring that the power remains in the Kim family. But, you know, I think the point is that it's about maintaining the stability of the regime. And I think that that collective mindset on all my trips to North Korea, that is very much paramount in understanding North Korea. And the best that we can do to try to change the conditions is to stop our hostile orientation towards that country.
That's Christine Ahn of Women Cross DMZ.
The British Health Service said the death toll from COVID-19 in English hospitals rose 370 to 20,853 cases. The National Health Services said that of the 370 who've died, 25 had no underlying health conditions. Dutch health authorities said the number of confirmed coronavirus infections in the Netherlands has risen by 445, bringing the total to 40,236. The National Institute for Public Health reported 94 new deaths, taking total COVID-19 fatalities to nearly 5,000.
Like many other institutions, the U.S. military has certainly been affected by the coronavirus. David Gibbs is a professor of history at the University of Arizona. We asked him about the effect the virus is having on U.S. military interventions all over the world.
It seems to be putting a restraint on U.S. interventionism. Today there was a report that Trump is considering a full withdrawal of all U.S. forces from Afghanistan on account of the coronavirus. One of the problems here is that, first of all, you could say the world and the United States is bigger fish to fry at this moment, and that we face an enemy in the form of a virus, which is a far more formidable enemy than any terrorist threat or any hypothetical threat from China or Russia. But in addition to that, the problem with the military is that it tends to concentrate personnel in small areas in ways that tend to be very good incubators for viral spread. We saw that dramatically with regard to the recent controversy surrounding the aircraft carrier, the USS Theodore Roosevelt. And, you know, this is a real problem, and it's not just for ships, but also for land personnel on land bases. And all of that basically does not augur well for continued use of U.S. forces during this pandemic. So I think it's quite natural that the United States would respond by reduced operational activity.
Do you think this is going to affect war in general and people's willingness to fight in the midst of this kind of disease?
Well, it would be very speculative, but certainly one possible outcome of this would be put a damper on military conflict in general, particularly by countries like the United States, which tend not to be very fond of things like, suicide charges and the like, which is, you know, if the United States were to undertake major operations now, it would be suicidal to some extent for large numbers of U.S. forces. And, you know, I suspect the forces would not be enthusiastic about that. Other countries would probably feel the same way. Now, terrorist forces might be different to some extent, but one could argue that threat has always been vastly overrated. I mean, the total number of Americans killed by the virus so far is well over 50,000 at this time and going upward. That is about 20 times the number killed in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And so it really puts into perspective the issue of sort of standard military threats that are often trotted out to justify vast expenditures. I think something else that has to be taken into account is the issue of money. Just one example, the United States just a couple of years ago fielded a new aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald Ford, which cost $13 billion. That's undoubtedly an understatement. It doesn't include things like, dockside support, training of forces, the aircraft put on the ship, et cetera. But $13 billion is much more than, the yearly appropriation, for example, the Centers for Disease Control. That puts into perspective, I think, the larger issue of the tremendous underfunding of things like public health and the danger of pandemics. In other words, there are some real security threats out there, like, viral disease that have really nothing to do or no useful purpose for the U.S. military. And so all of that, I think, could very well put a damper on current and future military engagements.
That's University of Arizona history professor David Gibbs.
Around the world, the 1st of May marks the celebration of International Workers' Day to honor the working class. This May Day, thousands of workers from multiple industries shrugged off social distancing rules and joined picket lines, demanding better wages, health insurance, and personal protective gear. Workers from Amazon, Walmart, and Target walked off the job in major cities in solidarity with essential workers. Observers say immigrant and undocumented workers have always been essential to the economy, but that they have been exploited the most. KPFA's Lola Akamu reports.
As many cities and states continue to grapple with the coronavirus, the month of May brought life into an ongoing labor movement to highlight the plight of those who have been deemed essential workers or frontline workers. These workers span various industries and are propping up sectors of a collapsed economy, all the while exposing themselves daily to the deadly virus. Earlier this week, President Trump issued an executive order to meat processing plants to remain open, despite reports of positive cases of the virus sweeping through multiple facilities throughout the country. Labor organizations and immigrant rights advocates have criticized the president's policies and attacks on immigrant and undocumented workers who make up a large percentage of frontline workers and are facing a grim future. Aviva Chomsky is a professor of history at Salem State University. She says immigrant workers have always been the backbone of society, but that they have also been the most exploited.
Whether they're documented or undocumented, immigrants are way overrepresented among underpaid, underbenefited, and exploited workers who are also suddenly coming to the fore as, oh, these workers are essential. We've been exploiting them as a country and as a system for centuries, and now suddenly we're promoting them as heroes, and yet we are still exploiting them. They're not being provided with personal protective equipment. Many of them are actually undocumented, so they aren't eligible for things like unemployment insurance.
Chomsky says social distancing is impossible for immigrant workers to maintain.
Most of them are not in the kinds of jobs where they're able to work at home. We're being given all of these messages about social distancing, about teleworking, messages that are aimed at basically the professional classes. Social distancing is impossible for immigrant workers who, first of all, their work makes them face the public. Secondly, they tend to live in poor neighborhoods, in overcrowded conditions, sometimes several families to an apartment. So it's just impossible to maintain social distancing. So it's this weird combination of visibility and invisibility that immigrant workers are facing right now. It's sort of an exacerbation of the kind of visibility and invisibility they have faced in the past.
Chomsky says there's a lot more that needs to be done to change the system.
But I think we need to do a lot more than vote if we want to change the system. And I would say that whoever our elected representatives are, it's our job to be creating pressure from below to force them to make the kinds of changes we want them to make.
Again, that was Aviva Chomsky, professor at Salem State University. I'm Lola Komu, reporting for KPFA News.
And you're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1. KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota.
Some observers have noted that comedians seem to be playing a major social commentary role in the time of the coronavirus pandemic. Sophia McLennan is a professor of international affairs and comparative literature at Penn State University. She's written about just such a phenomenon. We asked her how typical this was for comedians.
At a basic level, satirical comedy always wants to make fun of stupid responses to important things. So that's not especially surprising. But I think what we're seeing with comedians' responses to the pandemic, especially in the United States, is a little unusual.
In what sense?
So one of the things that I've been focusing on is the way that the comedians themselves often seem to be taking leadership positions, sort of suggesting, this is what we should do. These are the things we should be thinking about. This is the way we should approach this crisis. That's not a typical comedian thing to do, right? So comedians would generally either give us a break from the tension, right? So give us some sort of joke that helps us all have a laugh so we can deal with our stress. Or comedians might make fun of leadership, draw attention to flaws in the process and in the government. But what we're finding is you're seeing comedians actually perform sort of public service roles. And that's pretty unusual. That's not something that you would have seen Johnny Carson do.
Are you talking specifically about late night hosts or comedians in general?
Well, you know, it's a mistake to generalize across the board. A lot of the late night hosts, not all of them, but Stephen Colbert especially, his show is regularly hitting some of these issues. When President Trump suggested that it might be a good idea to ingest disinfectant and then later walked that back as an example of sarcasm, Colbert did a really excellent follow-up on that and said, nope, you know, I'm the one who's supposed to be sarcastic. You're the one who's supposed to be leading the country. And so what I find interesting is when the comedians like Colbert or John Oliver or Samantha Bee or Trevor Noah come out and say, this is what a president is supposed to do, and you're not doing it, which is really strange, because if you think about it, usually that type of ironic comedy isn't about sort of building up the pillars of society. In fact, if anything, it's making fun of the pillars of society. So they're defending the institutions in ways that I think are very different.
That's Penn State University professor Sophia McLennan.
The state of Louisiana incarcerates more people per capita than any other state in the U.S., and a majority of them are Black. Now, the largely Black prison population is threatened by COVID-19. KPFA's Ann Garrison reports.
Louisiana activists are battling to free Louisiana prisoners from what they call the COVID-19 death trap. Two of them spoke to the Black is Back Coalition's recent national teleconference. Here's Belinda Parker Brown of Louisiana United International.
Jim Crowism is alive and well here in the state of Louisiana. Institutional racism is alive and well here in the state of Louisiana. And you know, we had the war on drugs, and Louisiana took the lead and became the highlight over every other country that massively incarcerated people more than anywhere else in the world with the war on drugs. Then after that, we had Katrina. Katrina told the story while the whole world was watching us here in Louisiana, how bad we were being treated as Black people. Now we got the COVID-19. It's a death sentence on Black people here in the state of Louisiana. In our prisons and jails, it is horrific. And when we hear stories like people are dying inside of these jails because there is a lack of any type of administrative remedies, they are covering up the real truth. We just had a wife call me and said that her husband died in the prison and they did not even notify her. And they then buried him on the prison grounds without her even having the opportunity to know about the death of her husband. We got jails packed, people packed inside of these hellhole jails like sardines on top of each other. And there is no way that they can practice social distancing. There is no way possible that they can get the proper medical treatment and attention that they need because they're sick. We just had a situation where the warden died from the COVID-19. The medical director have died from the COVID-19. In one of the facilities, the whole kitchen trustee staff was infected with the COVID-19. Now, the inmates that are in the jail are striking because they're afraid to eat the food because it was contaminated.
Here's attorney Zena Crenshaw-Logal.
Our fight is against the colonial virus and the death chambers that it has turned the Louisiana detention centers and the jails and prisons into. That fight is based on fact and is based on law. The government reports on what is happening in Louisiana in their detention centers and jails and prisons are inconsistent with what people confined in those facilities are telling their family members, as Ms. Belinda indicated. So at this point, the government reports are unreliable, and we have reason to believe that everyone incarcerated in the state of Louisiana is at risk of dying of COVID-19 infections. And that means thousands of Black people may get sick or die in captivity.
That was Belinda Parker Brown and Zena Crenshaw-Logal, both of Louisiana United International. In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
A Supreme Court official said that nearly 10,000 prison inmates have been released in the Philippines as the country races to halt coronavirus infections in its overcrowded jails. Associate Supreme Court Justice Mario Victor Leonan told reporters that the move follows a directive to lower courts to release those awaiting trial in prison because they could not afford bail. Leonan told reporters as he announced the release of 9,731 inmates that the court is very much aware of the congested situation in our prison.
Local prison authorities told the Reuters news agency that inmates at a prison in Moines, a Brazilian city deep in the Amazon that has been hard hit by the coronavirus outbreak, have taken 7 prison guards hostage. The reason for the rebellion at the penitentiary was not immediately clear, but local television stations cited a video allegedly recorded by an unidentified inmate who complained of sweltering heat and a lack of electricity in the prison.
Many medical experts believe that testing is the key to combating COVID-19. To find out more about the importance of testing, we spoke with Craig Rowski, the CEO of Renegade Bio, a company that manufactures COVID-19 tests. We asked him how important testing is.
It is absolutely essential. The virus will continue to spread if people aren't allowed to know their status.
So would you say that everyone should be tested?
I think everyone should be tested, yes.
How feasible is that? Do you think that's something that can be done? Has it ever been done in the U.S. to test everyone for a disease?
You know, that's actually a really good question. I don't think we've ever tested everyone for a disease. I do think that in terms of getting this under control and getting people back to work and restarting our economy, we're going to have to test people.
How far along is your form of testing? What do you need to do to get it out on the market?
We are testing here in New York. We are looking to scale up our operations here in the city and as well in California, in Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area, which is where we started. That requires, you know, more staff. It requires partnering with people who can run the logistics of collections, which is one of the big hurdles, having the swabs and materials needed to collect samples from people. And then building out our facilities in Oakland and continuing to expand here in New York to take on more samples.
How many different kinds of tests are there? Is there one basic way to test people, or are there variations?
There are two general types of tests. One is a viral test, which is, you know, to put on my scientific nerd hat here for a moment. The viral test is quantitative real-time reverse transcription PCR. What that means in simple terms is that you take viral RNA, turn it into DNA, and then amplify or expand the concentration of that DNA in a tube, and you watch that signal grow, and that's how you detect the virus, by looking at its RNA. The other type of test is an antibody test, and that's looking specifically at the serology. Has someone been exposed? It answers the question, who has been exposed, while the viral test answers the question, who is currently dealing with an active infection? The only problem with using an antibody type test going forward to get people back to work, for example, is the fact that we don't know much about the antibodies. We don't know if they're protective. We don't know how long they are protective, if they are protective. We don't know if you can be reinfected with this virus, which in some cases, it's looking like that may be the case, suggesting that antibodies are not effective.
That's Renegade Bio CEO Craig Rowski.
The U.S. renewable energy industry is reeling from the new coronavirus pandemic. The coronavirus has delayed construction, put thousands of skilled laborers out of work, and caused doubts about solar and wind projects on the drawing board. In lockdown California, some local agencies that issue permits for new work closed temporarily, and some solar companies furloughed installers. In New York, New Jersey, SunPower's CEO Thomas Werner halted installations of more than 400 residential solar systems, fearing for his workers' safety. Trade groups say that as many as 120,000 jobs in solar and 35,000 in wind could be lost. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, fossil fuels such as natural gas and coal remain the leading providers of the nation's electricity, with nuclear power another key contributor. But renewable sources, wind, solar, hydroelectric, biomass, and geothermal have jumped in the last decade as production costs have fallen and many states have ordered utilities to make greater efforts to lessen their dependence on fossil fuels. And the weather. In the San Francisco Bay Area, partly cloudy tonight with lows in the 50s, sunny tomorrow with highs approaching 70. In Fresno and the San Joaquin Central Valley, lows in the mid-50s tonight, sunny tomorrow with highs in the low 80s. That's it for tonight's news. Thanks to Ann Garrison and Lola Akamu for helping to prepare tonight's newscast. Carla West is at the controls. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.